The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, what can ants teach us about making decisions?
Nothing an ant does makes any sense at all unless it's in terms of, well, how does it serve the colony?
And how can we use their evolved behavior to improve our lives?
When they get crowded, they actually turn into sort of like little incredible hulks. They change their color, they beef up their muscles, and they become very aggressive.
Can you diagnose autism with a brain scan? And does P equal NP? I've no idea what that means either. Plus, superheroes. We look at why psychologists say young boys need to be protected from all these superheroes.
But the more they stick to the actual written comic book figure, I think they're showing the vulnerability of boys and men and teaching a lesson about social justice.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. Nice to have you all back, my fellow worker ants. If you're all racking your brains about how to save your business money, or to streamline production lines, make transport routes more economical, or even control crowd behavior, well, don't bother trying to come up with any clever ideas yourself. Just steal them from nature. It turns out the worlds of business, politics, and technology have a lot to learn from the animal kingdom. Ants, bees, and fish can teach us a great deal about communication, organization, and decision-making. It's all detailed in a new book called The Smart Swarm, written by National Geographic reporter Peter Miller. He joins us from our studio in Washington, D.C. Peter, welcome to the podcast. Let's start by looking at how these ant colonies actually work.
The colony that I focused on was red harvester ants in Arizona, where a professor from Stanford, Deborah Gordon, was working. And the colony has to survive the heat. It has to survive competition from other red harvester colonies as well as from predators. There's always a lizard out there looking to slurp down some, you know, stray foragers. It has to find food. In this particular environment, food is scattered, so they can't rely on going to a particular place to find it. And each day, the colony has to allocate its resources in a way that solves all of those problems. And the research that Deborah Gordon was doing was on this particular problem that they're facing, which is what she calls task allocation. If you consider, for example, how many foragers does a colony need? It's like a budget. You know, if it was a business, it would be, you know, how much are we going to spend on R&D? You have to make strategic decisions, and each colony has a different style. But how does it work? Each ant is not smart enough to make decisions like this. It doesn't understand the needs of the colony. It doesn't even understand why it's doing what it's doing, if you listen to the experts. In fact, it doesn't even remember things from 10 seconds to the next 10 seconds. So everything has been evolved to work through interactions among the ants. Individually, each ant can't get much done, but put 10,000 of them together, and they can find the nearest source of food quickly and efficiently. The way they do it in Arizona is they send out foragers to search the neighborhood, and when one of them finds a little seed, it brings it back. Depending on the rate at which ants are bringing back seeds into the nest, there are a group of ants that stay right inside the entrance hole. Depending on the rate at which ants come back with food, that triggers the number of ants that go out. So it's a direct feedback situation where more ants coming back means there's more food out there. Fewer ants come back, you send out fewer ants to go find it. It's like a finely tuned, just-in-time system for allocating enough workers in a smart way.
And the ants themselves, they're communicating with each other, not through any means that we might recognize. It's more about hormones and smells.
Well, ants have a very complicated chemical system of communication. They learn lots of things about each other. For example, the ants that are waiting inside the nest entrance, when an ant comes back, it has to be one of their nest mates. So first thing they do is they smell to see if it belongs to their nest. They can tell instantly. If it doesn't, they'll attack it. The second thing is they'll be able to smell that this ant has been working outside because the hydrocarbons coating that it has changes in the sunlight. And the third thing is they'll be able to smell the food that the ant is carrying. So you put all those things together with the rate of interaction that I mentioned before, and you have a pretty good system.
So this has all been described by people like Professor Gordon and the great E.O. Wilson as well. I mean, he spent his life talking about ants. And they talk about ants in the individual units, as in the ants themselves, is not, as you say, not very smart or anything, yet this behavior of the colony emerges from that into what I think E.O. Wilson calls a superorganism. And could you just take us through what that is?
Well, a superorganism means that evolution is working, natural selection is working at the level of the colony, not the level of the ant.
So the ants are expendable in all of this?
The ants are quite expendable, unfortunately. It helps to think about the ants as components of the colony in the same way that our skin or our fingernails or our a cell in our heart or our blood are components in our body. They don't make any sense by themselves, but when you put them together in a body, then you have something that has needs and wants and problem-solving abilities.
So this is the next step. The problem-solving ability of ants is not restricted to just ants. I mean, we've used it. Your book describes many examples of how we've used the connections between ants to solve all sorts of problems, like boarding planes, for example.
Southwest Airlines had a problem a few years ago where they wanted to decide if it would be good for their business to change from open seating, which means you can pick any seat on the plane. I mean, they're one of the few airlines that do it that way. And they've done it that way for 40 years, so it was part of their identity. They didn't really want to change if they didn't have to, but they were getting pressure from business travelers primarily who didn't like the idea of having to get there early to get in a big line to find a good seat. They wanted reserved seating. So they asked one of their computer programmers to analyze this and figure out, well, if we do switch over from open seating, what's the best way to do it? And he looked at it a little bit and he thought, here we have a lot of individuals who are trying to cram into a tight space and optimize their own position, picking, you know, which seat. This is a biological problem. This is like the ants that I see in my own neighborhood. In Texas, they have lots of different kinds of ants. So he created a computer simulation with cognitive moving objects, he called them, which in his mind resembled ants. I mean, they were really just little computer programs that acted in the simulation according to the rules that he gave them. But he found out by running the program with the little simulated ants boarding the plane over and over and over again in different combinations, that it really wasn't to the advantage of the company to switch over. It was a little faster, but not fast enough.
Are there other examples of situations where you can use groups of social insects, essentially, the knowledge gained from that to, you know, improve the performance of something? It sounds like a very, very good solution to an engineering problem, that what the ants have done. Could you use it in engineering?
Well, absolutely. One of the most surprising examples that I came across was a company in Texas, again, Air Liquide, a U.S. division of a French company that makes industrial gases. And they have a very complicated business problem. They have 100 different factories making nitrogen, oxygen, argon, all kinds of gases. And they have thousands of customers, and they have hundreds of trucks, and they have pipelines. And on top of all of those, the price of electricity varies every 15 minutes in Texas because the rate is deregulated. So how to optimize that so they were getting the most profits from all of this activity? They had, over the years, developed various algorithms and systems to do this individually, which were working pretty well, but they needed something to pull it all together. So they brought in some complexity scientists who said, well, you know, an ant colony is a good model for this because they have to deal with complexity in their environment, and they've evolved certain behaviors that we have been able to translate into algorithms, in other words, mathematical instructions. So they took the algorithms from the ant colony and they applied it to the business problems of Air Liquide and came up with what they call their optimizer, which is a giant program that they run every evening. And they put in all the variables at 8 o'clock at night. They let the ant algorithms chomp away at them all night long, and in the morning it spits out a plan for them, which truck to go to which factory, how much gas to make at which plant, which customers get served first, and they've saved millions of dollars. And I thought that was just remarkable.
This is another logistics problem. The other thing that's interesting about ants, I suppose, is, again, this is another quote from E.O. Wilson. He said that ants and ant colonies developed the Industrial Revolution thousands of years before humans because of the way they distribute labor and they can efficiently organize themselves.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, they've been around 140 million years. There are 10 to 12,000 species of them living in every ecosystem. They've evolved to be successful in every crack and crevice of the planet. Along the lines of, practical application, there was a professor at University of Georgia, no, Georgia Tech, sorry, that was considering the behavior of the ants in the rainforest, that the leafcutter ants that carry objects back to the nest in what he called a bucket brigade. And the bucket brigade meant that the ant would carry a piece of leaf and until it met another ant, and it would pass it off to that ant, and that ant would then carry it a certain distance and pass it off to another ant until it reached the nest, and then it would be passed off to different specialized ants that would take it down into the nest, because they used the leaves to feed fungus. They were actually farmers. So he said, well, let's see, this looks like a pretty interesting way of taking care of tasks where you have to coordinate. And he applied it to a warehouse where you have to have sorters who are picking things off of shelves. Like think, for example, of a big book warehouse, or maybe a store for pharmacy supplies. You can imagine, the shelves and shelves and shelves, and each the way it works is you have a conveyor belt that comes running down through the middle of the plant with an order, and the pickers go and they go and find the item that needs to be in the particular order, and they fulfill the order sort of like on an assembly line. He said, well, let's try out this system where you use the bucket brigade. One person would go and get something until the person to their left was ready, and then he would take over the order from the slower person. And the fastest people, in other words, the people to the left that were fulfilling the orders, would take over, would grab the order from the people, just the way that the ants were grabbing the leaves from each other. And it turned out to improve the efficiency, I think, by 25%.
Now, we've been talking about how things can go and can be improved by working together. Do swarms ever fall apart or do things which you kind of don't want them to do?
Yeah, a famous example related to ants is the circular mills that have been reported among tropical ants, where, the ants, as we mentioned before, have chemical signals to each other. And one of the signals is follow me. When an ant lays down a pheromone trail, and another ant crosses it, it will follow that ant to food or to an enemy or back to the nest or whatever reason. And sometimes ants will follow each other in a big circle. So you'll have thousands and thousands of ants in a kind of whirlpool of ants, and they just keep going around and around and around until they all die because they can't break away from the instinct. And so in that case, that's a dysfunctional case of swarm intelligence.
You also talk in the book about mobs or stampedes, essentially groups where the communication breaks down. In particular, the various tragedies that have happened at football stadiums and places like that.
The behavioral model for this is locusts, which are fine when they have enough room for themselves in the desert. They're happy little grasshoppers. But when they get crowded, when the density of their population gets too high, they actually turn into sort of like little incredible hulks. They change their color. They beef up their muscles. And they become very aggressive. They become gregarious, as they say, which means that they seek out each other and they follow each other in lockstep. So that's how you go from these happy little grasshoppers to these gigantic clouds of insects that sometimes descend on little villages in the desert and eat everything in sight.
And that's not controlled by any central intelligence. I mean, is that purely hormonal?
Yes, it's entirely chemical. And the chemical involved in this is a form of serotonin, which is very interesting because it's the same kind of drug that you find in club drugs like ecstasy, which make people very social and want to seek out each other's company. But in this case, we don't know for sure that the locusts behave the same way under the influence of it. But their behavior is not smart. It's not like the ant colony or a beehive where their instincts are serving a useful purpose for the hive. In fact, it's more of a, as you said, a mob in which each of the locusts is really trying to survive. And in some cases, they turn cannibalistic, where they're trying to eat each other if they can't get food.
One final thing I'd like to ask. When you describe the behavior of a successful colony of ants, each individual unit doing a specific task, each one controlled and not by some central intelligence, but sort of as a group, but then the whole thing has some sort of intelligence. It sounds in some ways like a human brain. The neurons themselves don't have much, well, they have no intelligence. I mean, they're just functional units.
No, that's a very good point.
But then together, they create the human, a brain which can think, which can do things. I mean, are there any parallels there, and are people looking into that?
Absolutely. It's, it does sound like an attractive metaphor, but in fact, there are scientists, neuroscientists, who have been attending these conferences of animal behavior and making presentations about, for example, the way that a monkey brain works when it decides where to look. The processes that the neurons go through are very similar to the ways that ants behave. Each neuron reacts independently, but when they reach a certain threshold, then the eye will move to a direction that the majority of the neurons has directed it to. So there's some very serious research going into the similarities between the behavior of swarms and the behavior of the brain. And of course, the romantic idea would be that there's some cognition taking place in the swarm, but you can't dismiss the idea that, our own cognition may in fact have a mechanical, chemical similarity.
Peter Miller there talking to us from our studio in Washington, D.C. His book's called The Smart Swarm, and it's out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is uploaded. And to be alerted to all of the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow @GuardianScience.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's have a look now at some of the other stories around this week. In the studio is Nell Bowes, science correspondent Ian Sample, and The Observer's Robin McKee. We're going to try and do things a bit differently this week. I believe the Americans call this show and tell. Each of our panelists has brought in something to get us talking, so let's start with Robin. There's some interesting research out this week about why we think tool use might be older in humans than we first thought.
Yes, indeed. This is a discovery made in the Dikika region of the Afar region of Ethiopia. Researchers found animal bones, a cow-like creature, and one another the size of a goat, it's described here, with cut marks, deliberate cut marks, it appears, and they are 3.4 million years old. Previously thought that the first human species, Homo habilis, used tools about 2.5 million years ago. Now it appears this pushes it back at least 800,000 years. In other words, tool use amongst humans or our ancestors is far earlier than we thought.
Apart from that result, which is in itself quite interesting, what's the significance of using tools? What does it show us about our stage of evolution?
What we know later on, say about 2.5 million years ago, is that we were making tools. So it's,
and there's a difference.
There is a difference. Tool use is just picking up a very nicely useful sharp bit of stone and using it to cut. Making a tool shows that there is a mental image going on in an ape man's head, and he or she is forecasting a use for a piece of equipment. So we're seeing about 2.5 million years ago, there was clear tool-making ability in humans, and we're seeing 800,000 years earlier evidence of tool use. Now, the interesting thing is that these stones that they were using, they'd clearly carried for 3 or 4 miles to this destination, to where they were cutting these bones. So there was already some kind of mental ability, some mental imaging going on, in that they knew that this stone that they were picking up could have a use. There's no evidence that they were actually shaping it, but there was already the beginnings of some kind of neurological evolution going on there.
And there's something interesting about the fact that this stuff was being used to carve up meat.
Yes, indeed. Well, because meat is the kind of great leapfrog, the great revolution, the great leap forward in our diets. About this time, 3 million years ago, we moved from being mostly vegetarians and start killing and possibly cooking meat, but there's no evidence for how much that was deliberate. But what that does, it frees the gut to put in a whole lot of proteins that, you know, surge through our system and give us the kind of the resources for brain growth.
There's an interesting thing as to what was the driver for this, because if you think at the time, this place in the Afar was a lot of grassland, but a lot of forests as well. But these creatures were going out and scavenging, essentially. I mean, they were using stones and taking scraps of meat off bones. They were also cracking the bones apart to suck the marrow out, which is incredibly nutritious. But they were doing it at the same time that other fairly decent-sized carnivores would have been going for those carcasses and probably killed the animals in the first place. So this wasn't a risk-free venture for them. But for some reason, getting this kind of food and having that heavy in their diet was important, and there must have been a pressure for doing that, an evolutionary pressure for doing that. And I don't know what that was. I'm not sure that's laid down as clear yet.
Okay, moving on to something much more modern, Nell. Autism and a potential scan.
Yes, this was a piece that paper published in the Journal of Neuroscience, which was sort of widely reported as autism can be diagnosed with brain scans. This was the kind of the headlines around. What actually happened, Christine Ecker's team took 20 men with autism and 20 men diagnosed without autism and scanned their brains and managed to find an interesting differences in the shape of them. This was the most interesting bit of this piece seems to be really that the fact that they looked at five different parameters, five different possible differences in brain shape, and found that the differences that they found between people with autism and without depended on all five parameters. It wasn't possible to take just one and go, oh, well, this is predictive. So that's sort of quite an interesting part of it. The sort of the bit that then blew up was the idea that their results had a sensitivity of 90%.
It really is just a proof of concept, early stage thing. They have to extend it to women and to children as well. The researchers, Dr. Ecker and co, are very confident that it will extend to those sorts of people as well.
They have to take it outside the sample. I mean, they did it on a sample where they knew or they had a sort of previous diagnosis of autism to compare it with.
Exactly. When they do have this, it'll just be another bit of the diagnostic arsenal, rather than you walk in, you get a scan of 15 minutes, and then you have autism or not.
If these are not causal effect, but consequential effects, then studying the brains of children this way will not reveal that these children have autism. And that's when you want to get hold of an autistic person. It's when they're children, the younger you want to find them. So, I mean, until that crucial point is found out whether they're causal or consequential, then you haven't got a lot to go for here.
Well, absolutely. But that's the next step of this research, is to look at children. All of the effects are tiny, and I think that we're going to have more problems with stats and diagnosis and specificity. I'd encourage everyone to...
Can we have a session on probability and statistics?
Yeah, let's do that. And in the meanwhile, I would encourage people to read Carl Hannigan's blog on the Science blog. Ian, something even more complicated now.
I wouldn't say this is my favourite story of the week, but it's one that's intrigued me, and it's one that's also made me feel desperately inadequate for not, being close to being able to understand this kind of thing. But essentially, there is one of the greatest problems, essentially, in computer science is known as the P is not equal to MP problem, or P versus MP problem. And it's something that the Clay Mathematics Institute has named as one of its Millennium Prize problems, which there's $1 million waiting in a bank for the person who solves this. And a guy at Hewlett-Packard Labs in Palo Alto in California has posted a paper which seems to go a long way. It's kind of his first attempt. I think another paper is going to appear this week. a guy called Vinay Diolalika has done this potential solution, and it's being raked over by mathematicians pretty much all over the world to see if he's got it right. Now, what is this problem all about? Well, one way of looking at it is there are two kinds of problems that this actually relates to. There are some which you can solve essentially quite quickly. These are called P problems. And there is another called an NP, which means you can verify that the answer is correct very quickly. Now, let me just put it into some a bit more understandable sort of analogy. Think of a jigsaw. As soon as you see a jigsaw, you know well whether it's been completed properly or not. Does that mean that it's easy and can be completed quickly? I mean, it doesn't. But the thing is, if P equals NP, then that means every time you see and you can check an answer very quickly, if P equals NP, then it means you can also solve that problem quickly. Okay, so the verification and the solution can be done very quickly. What Diolalika found is that that's not the case, that just because you can verify something is correct quickly doesn't mean you can actually solve it from scratch correctly. Now, why does anyone care about this problem? Now, this is something that is probably very interesting to a lot of computer scientists who work on security and hacking problems like that, because a lot of security codes involve factorizing huge numbers and crunching huge numbers. And this really speaks to the limitations of computing in trying to do that kind of thing. And also problems like the traveling salesman problem. Kind of easy to see if a line between one place or another is probably the quickest way to get there. Very hard to actually solve that problem.
Robin?
Well, don't look at me, Alex. I thought there was going to be a joke about the travelling salesman, but unfortunately it was missing. I agree with Ian, totally.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad that P doesn't equal NP.
So does he get the £1 million, $1 million?
Well, there's an irony there in that his first paper came out last week. Some mathematicians have said, can you provide a few clarifications? So my understanding, he's going to come out with another paper this week. Now, what will be interesting is how long it takes him to verify that he's got the answer right. And it may well be that
if it's not in polynomial time.
Yeah,
then.
So this does end up being a bit circular. Polynomial time will come into it at some stage.
Polynomial time.
Possibly not polynomial.
Someone needs to link to that on the podcast page, which is at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Next up, let's Skype the US, where some psychologists are saying that superheroes are leading youngsters astray.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Sharon Lamb, and I'm a distinguished professor of mental health at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, a psychotherapist, and also co-author with Lynn Michael Brown and Mark Tappan of the book Packaging Boyhood, Saving Our Sons from Superheroes, Slackers, and Other Media Stereotypes. We ask them, what do they watch? What do they wear? What shops do they go into? What movies are they looking forward to seeing? What books are they reading? What sorts of games are they playing online? And one of the things that we found echoed from the movies that boys told us they love into all sorts of things, their clothing, their internet, their books, was this theme of superhero and also the theme of slacker. So when boys are watching movies about superheroes, they're also getting marketed in clothing lines, in Happy Meals at McDonald's, in all sorts of places, the same version of boyhood. And our primary interest was just to find what is it that marketers and the media are telling boys that boys should be like. And we know that they have a lot of influence in that, because otherwise they wouldn't be spending $12 billion a year to influence boys. The superhero that was being marketed to boys in movies and in their little action figures, even in coloring books, was a pumped up, hyper-masculine superhero who no longer put sort of saving the world and justice first, but used goals of justice and caring as excuses for violence, revenge, explosions. Basically, Hollywood has reformed the superhero to be just like any other action hero.
It's simple. Kill the Batman.
Will you be wanting the Batpod, sir?
Middle of the day, Alfred? Not very subtle.
The Lamborghini, then. Much more subtle.
So if a boy can't be a superhero or live up to that sort of hyper-masculinized stereotype, you know, being number one and ruling the world, you can always save face by becoming a slacker. And this is the sidekick or the class clown. And it's the other stereotype that we saw over and over again in boys' media. And I love some of those slacker movies that are out there anyway, the Will Ferrell movies and Jack Black.
Can we turn our beds into bunk beds?
You'll give us so much extra space in our room to do activities.
You're adults. You can do what you want.
This is the funnest night ever. Hey, I never asked you.
Yeah.
You like guacamole?
Excuse me. Okay. No, I did not just graze your boob.
But the problem is this sort of bombardment of these two images without making any room for other images of what boys can be, sort of the upstanding citizen or the boy who actually likes school or the boy who wants to join a chorus instead of be in a rock and roll band. I have a particular problem with Iron Man, who is sort of a playboy. Any of the playboy millionaires, I think, is sort of supporting this message to boys that to be successful, you have to have this incredible wealth, that you have to exploit women, and that your only vulnerability is if you actually fall in love with a woman or kryptonite.
Oh, it's good to be back.
The notary's here.
Front and center.
I'm sorry, he's very eccentric.
I want one.
No.
It's almost better to look at some of the comic books rather than the blockbuster movies, because comic books can develop characters quite a bit more.
I've never seen anything like this before.
We are the future, Charles, not them. They no longer matter.
Hold on to something.
When we look at the X-Men, I think we see some interesting stuff there, because there are women and there are men, and they all have backstories that remind us about lessons about oppression and social justice. I'm not sure that the movies that have been made from the X-Men all live up to the comic book qualities. The more the movies give you explosion after explosion and play up the macho action figure, revenge-seeking person, then they're playing into R-rated, age-old, hyper-masculine heroes.
Join me, and you will have your revenge. Wolverine.
The best lesson parents can learn is that they need to teach their kids to be media savvy, and that kids and boys are very willing to learn these lessons. They want to find the quote-unquote lie in the commercial. That's a game that we suggest people play. And they want to understand how, in some ways, marketers think they're dupes. And if you can teach them some of these rules, they can stand a bit apart from role models that marketers of the media are trying to sell to them.
Whatever life holds in store for me, I will never forget these words. With great power comes great responsibility. This is my gift, my curse. Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Peter Miller for popping into our studio in Washington, D.C., and from San Diego, Professor Sharon Lamb for Skyping us, as well as this gaggle of Guardian folk, Nell Catwoman Bowes, Captain Scotland, a.k.a. Robin McKee, and Ian the Joker Sample. Next week, we'll be setting astronomy writer Stuart Clark some big questions about the universe, And there's going to be lots of other smashing stuff that producer Andy hasn't quite decided on yet. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by our very own Wonder Woman, Andy Duckworth, with thanks to Supergirl, Monica Desai. I'm Alok, the Green Hornet, Jar. Thanks for listening to infinity and beyond. Can you do something weird with that last bit? To infinity and beyond. Yeah, do that. The Hamburglar is not a superhero. He's more of a villain. A Hamburglar, Grimace, all that lot. No, but if you think of it, Ronald McDonald is a clown. Hamburglar steals his hamburgers. And he's got... Is Grimace a good guy or a bad guy? These weren't superheroes, though. They were McDonald's characters. This podcast was produced by our very... I hadn't read that before. To infinity and beyond. That doesn't work that last... To infinity and beyond. How does he say it? That doesn't really work for me. Supergirl. We need another superhero. There's loads. Oh, what about the Jennifer Garner character in the Ben Affleck movie where he's blind? Just Google female superhero. She had a film to herself and everything. Daredevil. She was in Daredevil. Elektra. Okay. All right, well, let's stick with Supergirl.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.